Wilfred Sheed is a well-known figure in the literary world, a world he satirized in his recent novel, The Boys of Winter. His parents, Frank and Maisie, were important figures in a different part of the book world. They ran the iconoclastic Catholic publishing company, Sheed and Ward. They started the company in London in 1926 and moved the company and the family to America in 1933. Although he grew up in a book-obsessed family, Wilfred Sheed's main childhood preoccupation was sports. But he had to give up playing ball when he got polio at the age of 14. That's when he turned to books. Sheed is the author of several novels, a memoir about his parents, and two collections of essays, which include his book reviews. He's been a Book of the Month Club judge since 1973. Sheed wrote the text for the new book, The Kennedy Legacy, A Generation Later, which features photos by one of John F. Kennedy's personal photographers, Jacques Lowe. In the book, Sheed says that he asked himself the question, why were we so impressed with Kennedy at the time? And looking back at Kennedy's life and career, Sheed found himself revising some of his original views.
Well, I had more or less been following the flow, which seemed to be running entirely in a critical direction, and me following along with all the other fish. And it was only when my friend suggested that we do a book, and my first response was, well, I'm not sure he's worth it. And then we talked, and I realized that I had been accreting opinions that I wasn't so happy with, and I did remember quite enough to write a book about, and indeed a book of celebration. I think that the tendency to level our monuments is, I think Tocqueville warned us, this is a sign of democracy in action, and people simply wanted to bring him down in some way, I felt. Besides, the very good arguments, particularly relating to Vietnam. Vietnam seems a great deal worse because it was made worse by subsequent presidents. As left by Kennedy, it remains something of an enigma.
I would like for you to evaluate Kennedy's speeches from the vantage point of a literary critic. What did you think of his speeches?
Well, I had a certain amount of trouble with the rolling qualities that Sorensen put in. I could see that they were catchy and perhaps necessary. But beyond that, Sorensen really wasn't a bad writer at all. If he hadn't taken whatever course in rhetoric that one had to just keep rolling and going any distance and walking any mile and toting that barge, lifting that bale kind of stuff, if you subtract the rather pulverizing lilt, you actually have very good language and clearly very close to what was on Kennedy's mind. I think that the words approximate the thought more than they are normally required to do in political discourse.
Novelist and critic Wilfred Sheed is my guest, and he's written the text for a new book called The Kennedy Legacy, which features photographs by Jacques Lowe. In your book, The Boys of Winter, which is a satire of the literary world, the narrator says at one point that he'd forgotten how dull culture can be in the wrong hands. And he's referring to people sitting around talking about painting. And I wonder who you think the wrong hands are.
Well, in the days when I used to review culture, as it were, I finally came to believe that culture meant you can't smoke. Of course, nowadays you can't smoke anyway, so that's that definition is gone. But there seemed to be something also reminiscent of Bernard Shaw said, an Englishman feels he's being moral when he's only being uncomfortable about culture, that it was a way of coming in from the sunshine on a nice day in order to hear chamber music. It didn't have the joy that the creator himself had. And in fact, I have found that the artists themselves are not great devotees of culture. They're devotees of what they're doing. And I think one of the greatest gaps in the world is between patrons of the arts and artists. I think two more different types of human being can hardly be found.
Would you explain that a little more?
Well, go to a party of fundraisers, the sort of people who regularly support the arts. And just imagine replacing this with a party given by painters for each other. And I think say no more.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you're talking about patrons, which are just one particular breed of people who are interested in the arts.
What interests me is, though, that the patrons of the arts don't feel any spiritual identification at all. Of course, it's disastrous if they do. If they try dressing like artists, it would look very sad indeed. But they don't see any anomaly between dressing up in this way,
mm-hmm.
and then making a rather stuffy occasion of art,
mm-hmm.
Which is in fact produced by a somewhat wild and the sort of man who doesn't sit still
and woman,
yes, oh, man and woman, my goodness, yes.
Now, you are both a novelist and critic, so you have lived and worked in two different, also often conflicting worlds. You write that as an author, receiving a bad review is like being spit on by a complete stranger in Times Square. Has that feeling ever held you back from writing a bad review?
It finally held me back from writing any reviews at all. I do very, very few these days. At least of living people, because, just to be crass about it, I don't need any more enemies. As a novelist, you really don't need any more than the course of life is going to send you. but also, yes, on humane grounds, I think that that you lose the killer instinct as you go along. I think that criticism can be a blood sport, and really to be indulged by the young. As you get old, you imagine that perhaps the person is ill, or you imagine all the situations that have happened to yourself at one time or another, and you really can't go on giving it. You know how much it hurts.
But you don't think that criticism plays a higher function than just panning a new book or dishing the writer?
Yes, I suppose when I talk about panning, I really never did enjoy it. People seem to assume that this is the part of their work that critics really enjoy the most, and I suppose, you know, one can indulge oneself in this. There are probably more rich, hostile words in the language than nice ones, but I have really enjoyed writing favorable reviews, Actually, I think criticism itself goes way beyond praise and blame. Once you, with criticism as opposed to reviewing, is that you assume that the reader is familiar with the work of art or will make himself so, and then you can talk. This is the talk of people who have gone beyond the question of whether it's good or bad, and now just want to talk about the thing itself. And that kind of criticism I would still like to do.
Mm-hmm. Wilfred Sheed is my guest, a critic and novelist, and the author of the text for a new book called The Kennedy Legacy. Now, your parents, Frank and Maisie, were the leading Catholic publishers in their time in both the United States and England. Was it intimidating for you to start writing knowing that your parents were important in the world of publishing and religious publishing?
I was intimidated by them, but not because they were publishers, because I knew even then that the very best publishers publish a great deal of bad writing. But I was somewhat intimidated by something my father particularly did, which he wasn't aware of. He was sublimely unaware of. He had a way of suggesting that stuff written by very young people would look silly to them a few years later. He never said it directly in reference to me. He said it in reference to other people. And I picked up the notion, so I wrote nothing but humorous stuff. I was going to say until I was 45, but it wasn't quite that long. But I fell into a habit of writing humorously because I knew that that particular gift is one that peaks early, like lyric poetry. If you take a good college humor magazine, it will be as sophisticated as those men will ever get. Whereas if they attempt a serious magazine, they will get a good deal better if they're going to be any good.
I've never thought of humor as something that peaks early. It's an interesting way to look at it.
I think if you take the great American humorists, be they Perelman, Thurber, Benchley, they all had their primes before 40,
mm-hmm.
and indeed began to sweat after.
Well, you were very athletic when you were growing up, and you didn't much like books. That changed, I think, when you got polio when you were, I believe, 14 years old. Were you surprised when you were ill to find that you actually enjoyed reading?
No, I had done a little furtive reading before that.
Furtive, huh?
Yes. It was the difference between...
You were hiding it from friends or parents?
Oh, from friends. Mm-hmm. No, for parents, I would I would strut it. But the sort of friends I knew were not readers themselves, and they really didn't... This was if you can be macho at the age of 10, that's what we were, by golly. And you weren't going to read more than the other fellow. Although, of course, there were certain approved texts. Comic books were perfectly all right. But it was the difference you get from reading constantly. Suddenly the whole thing starts flowing together. Instead of being a passage here and a passage there, you are seeing the whole sea at once when you read. I remember reading an Evelyn Waugh a day until I'd gone through, you know, the pre-war ones. And the same with the Graham Greene thrillers. And reading at that speed gives you a much different, a much sharper and fuller picture of the object read.
Your parents sent you to Warm Springs when you had polio, which was the place that FDR went to. And when you got there, you thought of it as a gigantic hoax. This is the place that there were waiting lists for people with polio to be sent to. Your parents managed to get you in. Why did it seem like a gigantic hoax to you?
Well, because it was. I mean, it didn't just seem like one then. It seems like one today as I look back on it. The subject almost asked for a hoax because people who have polio will believe in anything. And this was the closest secular version to faith healing that could be imagined. And part of the mythology depended on the fact that Roosevelt always concealed his own legs. And therefore, we felt somehow that Warm Springs had cured him. And if you have the will to believe to that extent, you don't look under the table. And so it went with us that my family and I tried quackier cures than that. This at least was respectable. No harm came to you from it. And at the end of it, they simply resigned you to having polio. You were surrounded by other people with it. You did see people in much worse straits than yourself. And at the end of it, you thought, well, this is a way of life. It had become normal to you to see people in this state.
You also write that the experience left you suspicious of organized charity and tear-jerking posters.
Well, yes. In this particular case, for instance, they showed this young fellow in a brace, and he went on year after year wearing his brace. I should have suspected something about him. But they simply find the most pathetic and photogenic subject they can. And once upon a time, I worked for Bishop Fulton Sheen in a mission organization. And we used to run pictures of lepers. And we would get protests from the the leprosy people to saying, we really have leprosy pretty well in hand. What good are these posters doing? To which we could only say, well, they're pretty. In a fundraising way, ugly is pretty. And never mind information of any sort. If the picture is pathetic enough, you'll assume these people have a cure for it. It's mesmerizing.
And you didn't object to these ads?
Well, I objected, and I didn't stay very long.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't object very strenuously because they did raise money for quite different things. I mean, the money did not go to leper colonies because we couldn't find any. But the money did go to very worthy things, but of a rather dull nature. If you showed a picture of a priest in China going his rounds, you wouldn't draw flies. But you show someone dying of gangrene, and you will pack the house.
Did polio have any lasting physical effects on you?
Yes, I still have a limp, and I was a sort of borderline case. I was still able to swing a golf club, although not walk the length of a golf course, things of that sort. So I got a bit of everything. I had an absolutely wicked serve at ping pong. And just enough, once again, as Warm Springs had finessed the trauma of the thing, then being able to take part in things has finessed the rest. So I can't say that at any stage that this was a terrible, shattering experience.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your life and your writing, but first we're going to take a short break. Wilfred Sheed is my guest. He's a novelist, essayist, and his latest book is titled The Kennedy Legacy. He wrote the text for a book that also includes photographs by Jacques Loeb. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest writer Wilfred Sheed has written books of essays, biographies of Muhammad Ali and Claire Booth Luce, several novels, including last year's The Boys of Winter, which is a satire of the literary world. Now, you had said right before our break that that polio wasn't as traumatic an experience for you as we might have thought. Do you think it finally led to your being a writer, since it forced you away from athletics and got you more inside the world of books?
I think it probably made me a different kind of writer. I think I probably would have wound up writing whatever happened, although I had at that age pictured myself as a lawyer. That sounded as if it covered just about everything, and even conceivably as a politician, because I think it would be slightly abnormal for someone of 14 to picture himself sitting at a desk all day. I suppose the halfway house, the image that brought most of us towards writing was that of a sort of Hemingway who was covering wars in between books.
You moved to the United States at the age of 9 with your parents, and they were coming here to start an American branch of their publishing company, their Catholic publishing house. And you say that there was nothing about skyscrapers and Hollywood that prepared you for the Catholic Church in America. What was so astonishing about the Catholic Church in America compared to the church in England that you were used to?
Well, I, of course, being 9 years old, wasn't very used to anything at that point. And I certainly hadn't sampled the Catholic Church in England to any sort of extent. The Catholic Church in America was different from any kind of experience, be it religious or be it otherwise. But it would take me books and books. In fact, I did write a book about my parents in which I tried to tangle with this question. But the difference could not be summed up in a couple of phrases.
You say that having a church in your backyard is like owning a theater. Would you explain that a little bit?
Well, yes, I suppose you felt that it was a family show that was being put on. And the parish priest was, of course, a very close friend. He used to, I believe he taught me how to bowl a cricket ball, that sort of thing. And then we'd all troop into church together and play that particular role. And a very small child isn't really aware of what being in church is about. So it parallels other things, and family theatricals would be about the closest. And then I became an altar boy, which meant that I actually got to dress up for the part. And I swung, one of those incense thurible, and felt no end of a performer as a result.
So your family felt something like a showbiz family to you?
Well, again, I had nothing to compare it with, but I guess I did get a somewhat more colorful feeling about my family than most people would have about theirs. And as I say, I was probably the hammiest altar boy who ever genuflected.
Did you ever rebel against Catholicism?
No, that's a hard one to say, because I remember I decided at the age of 16 or so, maybe even earlier, that I wasn't going to leave the church over sex. I thought that the church was about something more important than that. And that actually took the starch out of any rebellion, because that's actually what makes rebellion really hum, is that it's powered by a sexual drive. And I thought the church doesn't doesn't seem to me to make any sense about sex, but then neither does anybody else. I mean, the things seem to me quite insoluble. If people are born able to procreate at 13 or so and then have somehow to manage this so that they can raise children, you're going to have ridiculous solutions to it. And I decided the church was really about encounter with God and that sort of thing, and that the sex thing would think about it when I was too old to care, perhaps.
When you said that you decided you weren't going to leave the church over sex, did that mean that you would follow the church's teachings on sex and therefore not leave, or that you would ignore the church's teachings, follow what you thought about it, and not leave the church?
Well, in those days, it would be nice to think that I thought, yes, I'll keep my fingers crossed about this. That, of course, is what one would do now. At the time, I must say, that caused a good deal of grief. And, again, this would take more time than we've got, but I believe I was getting more out of the plus side of religion than I was losing to the negative. And there were periods when I decided to let I would go for as many months between confessions as it was legally possible to do, and I had the usual joke situations where one had to pretend one had felt dizzy instead of going up to communion. It all sounds so richly comic, and it was so richly tragic at the time. I suppose that it wouldn't have been so funny if we hadn't been so serious about it.
What's the role of Catholicism in your life now?
Well, as whoever it was said, they'll have to throw me out. I still find myself very comfortable with the notion of a universal Christianity as opposed to a localized one. And again, the matter of interpretation would not only take a long time, but I could almost guarantee it would bore you.
You first came to America when you were 9. You returned to England to go to prep school, then returned back to the United States. When did you stop feeling like a foreigner in America?
That took a long time. I suppose, actually, when I had children. And my children weren't foreigners. Then I knew that I couldn't very well be myself. Also, of course, people stop noticing an English accent, and then it really takes...
You don't have a very strong one.
Actually, I have a stronger one electronically than I have in real life, I believe, because my son first heard me on radio when he was very small and said, "Well, you're English," which had never occurred to him before.
When you were young and had just come to America from England, was it considered a feat to have a British accent?
With the guys I ran with, yes, it was definitely a feat. These were tended to be Irish Catholics. My natural colleagues in life are Irish Catholics, and I've had to make my peace with them. And I was not only stuck with a plummy Cockney accent, but also a ridiculous first name.
Oh, Wilfred. Did you try to shorten it to Fred or Willie?
I managed to impose Bill on as many people as I could, but then my parents would come around and say, "Oh, Wilfred," and then I'd have to start all over again.
Did you try for a Brooklyn or New York accent when you were young?
Well, I wanted an American one. I myself thought English sounded very silly, and I thought it sounded very nice when girls spoke it, but hopelessly effete when boys spoke it. And I know many people would go out of their way to speak with an English accent. Well, I went out of my way not to. It was really a safety device. It was a life-saving one, as far as I was concerned. Not to say coffee or third. Or not, in fact, not to talk like Governor Keene or Kane.
What about your writing? Do you think of your writing as having more of an American or of an English accent?
Well, I decided after I read Thurber, I'd gone back to England and was out of sorts about the whole thing. And then I read the Thurber Carnival, and I thought, that's what I want to write like. And so I would credit Thurber with making me want to write American rather than English.
Mm-hmm.
But then, naturally, the other stuff comes in the back door, and I will find I'm using English locutions and an English vocabulary. But it's on an American spine, or at least I trust so.
Are you still on the board of the Book of the Month Club?
Yes, I am.
How long have you been on it?
15 years.
It's a long time.
Yes.
I've always wondered what the qualifications are for a book to make it into the Book of the Month Club. How do you read it? What are you looking for when you're judging it for getting in?
I would say accessible quality. I mean, it's got to be good, but it's also got to... Actually, my father referred to his publishing house, Sheed and Ward, as aiming at a spot just above the middle of the brow. And I suppose that might be the spot that we're still aiming at. From a very high eminence, from an academic eminence, it will seem middle brow. And from underneath, it will seem just a little bit above. But in fact, well, Graham Greene and Updike, a Bellow, these we take as a matter of course. So I think middle brow is a little bit harsh.
Have you ever been in the Book of the Month Club yourself?
No, as a judge, I am banned for life from this.
I know that the politics of book reviewing has made you uncomfortable over the years. What about the politics of serving on the board of the Book of the Month Club? It's a lucrative deal for any author who gets in. You're likely to get a lot of sales out of an arrangement like that.
Yes, I always picture myself as a bank teller who hands out millions of dollars every day and then goes back to his garret.
Wilfred Sheed, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
And my guest has been essayist and novelist Wilfred Sheed, and he's just written the text for a new book titled The Kennedy Legacy, A Generation Later, which features photographs by Jacques Lowe. It's published by Viking. Sheed is also the author of the literary satire The Boys of Winter. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.